Welcome back to Hash Fed Up. Today is all about Dig. Dig, or Digital Infrastructure Group, is a company in the US that is busy with greenfields, infrastructure, site management, energy management, cybersecurity, and all the other good stuff. I don't know much about that, so I wanted to invite Ryan Knuckles, a managing partner over there, to talk about his company and what it is exactly that they do. Enjoy. All right, guys. So like I said in the brief introduction, I am here today with Ryan Knuckles. I hope I pronounced that correctly. We're going to speak about his company, managing partner over there, founder as well, DIG, Dig, or Digital Infrastructure Group. Ryan, how did I pronounce your name? How are you?
Doing really good, Jesse. Thanks for having me on the show today. Glad to be here. Ryan Knuckles, you pronounced it just right.
Perfect, you want to say. Perfect pronunciation. We have block height 840953, hash rate on the 14-day 644.7, and the hash price is at 56.98. Now, frequent listeners will have noticed that there aren't many blocks in between the last weeks, in between last week's episode and this week's episode, because I recorded it a couple of hours ago. We just saw record lows on hash price. Ryan, how does that impact your business, if at all?
You know, obviously the halving is always a tough situation when mining rewards are cut in half, profitability is cut in half, but we're still seeing such a massive demand for data infrastructure where really the new entrants coming into the market are just, you know, forced to buy higher compute terahash machines. And so, you know, in complete honesty, the boom time for infrastructure is still happening. Just operators are just being a little bit more efficient and smart with their investment dollars and what type of terahash they're acquiring.
Okay, cool. Tell my audience, Ryan, a bit about what it is that your company does, that you founded, and what it is that you do besides Digital Infrastructure Group as well.
Absolutely. Just to give a quick, simple background on myself, 10th generation Texan. Family has been in Texas for over 200 years. We have very deep ties in the oil and gas and utility industry. When I graduated business school in 2013, I joined my family oil and gas firm. I was leading business development efforts. My brother-in-law married into the family, and he had worked for a large power provider at Dallas. And essentially one day on the golf course, we launched an idea to start a retail electricity provider. A retail electricity provider simply supplies electricity to consumers in the market, manages their electricity, and trades their power. So we started a company called Pump Jack Power, and that was solely tailored to the oil and gas industry. I myself have been invested into Bitcoin since 2011. I'm a big poker player. And so a lot of my early Bitcoin holdings came from just simply getting paid out in Bitcoin. As I kind of developed in the energy industry, I started to realize that Bitcoin mining was such a massive energy optimization tool. And so in 2018, we started to get our first round of calls at Pump Jack Power of data miners hunting for cheap electricity in Texas. And so in 2019, I actually launched Crypto Power, which is a subsidiary of Pump Jack. Crypto Power is also a retail electricity provider focused on supplying electricity and managing electricity to data operators in Texas. In actuality, our credit facility that allows us to buy, sell, and trade power actually told us that it was too risky of an industry to supply electricity. And so we actually moved on from that credit facility about a year and a half later and into the market in early 2021. About a year and a half ago, I saw the need to provide essentially just a full turnkey solution from permit to power flow. So I went out and started Digital Infrastructure Group, DIG, or DIG, as you want to call it. And essentially what DIG does, Jesse, is we provide turnkey asset development. So we have kind of different buckets of services. Our first service is simply site development. So with our site development services, we basically development team. We put together scopes of projects to your liking. So if you want to go do a 20 megawatt project in Texas, We pretty much get your interconnection approval, your land agreement, your permitting done, and obviously your approved credit line to flow power. Once the site development services are completed, we essentially move into infrastructure solutions. And so DIG acts as a general contractor to essentially engineer, procure infrastructure, and construct those infrastructure assets. So in a very simple sense, we're a general contractor that goes out and builds out infrastructure for data operators in Texas. And then lastly, our asset management services, we are focused on energy optimization for crypto power, managing electricity, trading your electricity. And then we offer facility maintenance support. So any type of maintenance issue within the facility, we as an infrastructure company, we have the full capability to support you. And then lastly, we just launched a cybersecurity division that I'm super excited about, where we have the capability to protect your infrastructure from the firmware level all the way back to the back office. I live in Austin, Texas, born and raised. Austin is actually the home of the U.S. Army Cyber Command. We've put a really great team of cybersecurity professionals to not only help protect, but also optimize your infrastructure at the data level as well. So what I'd like to tell people, Jesse, is we have a big toolbox. However, people need help and solutions. You know, we're a real pick and play type company, and we're here just to help and serve the industry.
Cool. I want to go through that toolbox a bit. I want to dig a bit deeper, pun intended. Into what each of those tools does and understand more about the value that you guys provide. Just from the poker angle, how many other Bitcoiners do you know that came into Bitcoin because of poker? I've never heard that before.
You know, there's quite a few, and even in the kind of gambling route, a lot of early Bitcoiners simply got into Bitcoin through poker or online gambling. Last June, I actually played in a BTC poker tournament. It was a charity poker tournament for Satoshi Action Fund.
Oh, nice.
And got second place, lost in a pretty tough hand. But the Bitcoin community has a lot of poker players, which is a lot of fun. I mean, I really just played as a hobby now. But a lot of early Bitcoiners really did get in through poker. So it's a cool community to be a part of.
I have a couple more questions on that. Like, how did the payout work? Did you pay it out to your own wallet? Was it like a host? Was it a software wallet hosted with somebody else? Like, how did that work? And how did you exchange it into fiat back then? Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it was simply just a cold storage type situation and putting things on flash drives. Then the first exchanges started to come out, and luckily I kind of saw the writing on the wall and got my BTC off Mt. Gox before it went south. But a lot of my early BTC holdings still are sitting on flash drives and safes and safety deposit boxes, which is kind of funny.
Nice. Awesome. All right. Cool. Dig. So first step, you guys, basically, if I come to you, and this is how I kind of want to play this, is I come to you as a customer, right? And I tell you, hey, I want to start mining. I need a data center. What is the first step for us? How do we figure out how much capacity we're going for? What is needed to get a site, you know, into my hands that I can start building on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very good question, Jesse. What we simply do is after we execute, you know, our customer agreements, we sit down with you and just understand what your budget looks like and what your kind of goals for your infrastructure is. You know, if you're a hosting provider, you know, that's a different set of budget requirements. If you're a direct miner, that's a different set. Or if you're an AI company or high compute, everything kind of has different levels in terms of what your budget limits are. So, you know, if you have X amount of dollars and you want to be a direct miner, we essentially look at you and say, okay, you know, with the amount of capital that you have in place, you know, you can go do 10 megawatts relatively safely and have some operating capital left in the bank. So after we review kind of your proof of funds and your capital allocation, we simply just say, hey, this is what we would recommend for you to move forward on. And then depending on what they come back with, we start there.
Why is there a difference between hosters and direct miners?
There's different limitations in terms of capital outlay between a hosting provider and a direct miner. You know, when you're a hosting provider, all you're really doing is putting capital into, you know, physical real estate, the infrastructure, dropping power, you know, either building a building or containers. And then you have to put up some type of, you know, energy deposit with the power company, i.e. Crypto Power, and also the transmission company. When you are a direct miner, you have to do all of that as well if you want to own your own facility, but you also have to buy machines, right? And buying ASICs is really the biggest capital outlay. So people just kind of get over their skis a little bit in terms of, well, hey, I want to go do a, you know, 100 megawatt facility, but they only have the capital outlay to go buy maybe 10 or 15 megawatts worth of machines. But then they say, well, hey, I want to do hosting and direct mining. You know, putting an energy deposit down for 100 megawatts is millions of dollars, right? And so it's sometimes it's a little tough kind of getting people's heads out of the clouds a little bit. And what I like to tell people is it's a lot easier to start small and go big with the snowball. It's harder to walk back a situation once infrastructure is in place and you're running out of money and not having to, you know, reach this big goal. And so that's why I always try to put people in locations where, hey, if you want to have scalability and grow that snowball over time, you absolutely do. But be reasonable in your budget restrictions and don't come out of the gate too fast. You know, there's nothing wrong with taking your time and building up your infrastructure the right way, because those energy deposits on the supply and transmission side for a lot of power is sometimes a capital outlay that not a lot of people understand in terms of, hey, what is an energy deposit? What does an energy deposit do? And an energy deposit, just so you know, people always ask, well, why do I have to pay an energy deposit? You know, an energy deposit on the supply side basically gives you trade liquidity to go buy that power, right? So a 10 megawatt trade for my energy company is about a $25 to $30 million financial commitment that my company has to go collateralize the wholesale level. That's why we have a credit facility that allows us to basically work off their credit line for us to go buy and trade and supply you wholesale electricity. So on that 10 megawatt load, that credit situation that you put down is simply giving yourself liquidity on the supply side and on the billing side. And so we actually were one of the first energy companies in the world to partner up with a company called Sunnova. Austin Mitchell is a good friend of mine. Sunnova basically leverages the Lightning Network to help settle energy payments all time. And so by doing that, you greatly decrease the counterparty risk of supplying electricity. And so, you know, there's very creative ways to offer solutions. You just kind of have to kind of see what they are before thinking. But the biggest thing is when you're developing infrastructure, stay within your budget. You know, don't try to go too crazy. You know, work with industry professionals who have your best interests at heart, and start small and go big.
Okay. Yeah, I want to talk about the power side, because again, that's another tool that's in your toolbox, right? But let's stay on the greenfields, mm-hmm. As they're called, for mm-hmm. a little bit. First of all, can you also, for myself and for my audience, dissect the differences quickly between greenfields and brownfields for me?
Yeah, so essentially greenfield locations are locations with no power installed. It's basically just raw dirt. These are locations that I really specialize at, because as me as an ERCOT power provider and you know, industry energy professional, I'm very good at understanding power flow studies, kind of where power is, and really areas across the world that is really good power quality, because not all power is created equal. And so greenfield locations are just simply starting from scratch. Brownfield locations are existing infrastructure that might have a little bit of infrastructure in place or a built out facility. The greenfield locations are a little bit more cost savings in terms of not having to go out and buy an existing facility. But there is time value of money of buying already built out infrastructure. We do broker sites for some folks, but our main focus at Dig is the greenfield opportunities, just simply because that's really our specialty in understanding where power flow is, the best power quality is maintained, and it's honestly the best bang for your buck and not having to go pay a premium for a brownfield site.
How easy is it to find good power, 10 megawatts in Texas? I mean, not everybody obviously in the audience is from there. Can you make me understand how liquid that sort of real estate is? I mean, you know, if you say, hey, it's a piece of dirt, I assume there's a lot of pieces of dirt in Texas. And so you're saying they're not all created equal. How easy is it to find good ones? Is it like a needle in the haystack that you obviously getting paid to find, or is it, you know, pretty abundantly available?
Very good question. Obviously, Texas is a large landmass. Texas has four transmission zones in the ERCOT market: west, north, south, and Houston. Every transmission zone has its own characteristics in terms of power pricing and transmission quality. The simple way to say it is there's a lot of energy in Texas. Right now, you know, our summer peak demand hit close to 85,000 megawatts per hour. It's estimated that the ERCOT market should see anywhere between 120 and 150,000 megawatts per hour, which is a crazy number. So there's a lot of energy in Texas, but you really just have to understand the power flow qualities and where the best transmission quality is and where areas of high energy demand is coming from. And so, you know, you could be an area way out in the middle of the desert that doesn't have the greatest transmission quality, but maybe has got a lot of generational output, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the best wholesale transmission rates. You might get cheap power, but you might get bad transmission qualities. So it's just simply understanding the grid system. And that's something that, you know, my experience as an ERCOT energy professional for the last close to 10 years has really paid off, because just me simply having the experience to navigate through the ERCOT grid and other ISOs across North America.
So when you, I don't know, hear announcements of new solar or wind farms coming online in Texas, is that something you look at, try mm-hmm. to forecast what that does to power quality and power flow and stranded capacity potential in the grid, and then you try to find sites around that in advance? Is that something you do?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're more so talking about is more behind the meter opportunities, which we've done. It's just really understanding the on-grid capabilities of certain areas and understanding the power quality associated with that area. There are some groups that prefer to be behind the meter, right? And behind the meter essentially means where you're going and tapping into a generational resource, whether it be, you know, solar or wind, a natural gas turbine facility, maybe a flare stack. And there's advantages and disadvantages of doing that. And then the on-grid opportunities are obviously, you know, pulling from public substations or building your own substation infrastructure to operate. You know, while building substation infrastructure is a little bit costly, the benefits that you get as a hard asset for your business of building out your own transmission distribution point, i.e. a substation, is really massive, because it's a hard asset that's going to grow in value over time, and you're going to get the wholesale transmission quality of power. So every situation has its advantages and disadvantages. It's just simply built upon, you know, what type of capital outlay you have, what your timeline goals are, and really where you want to go as a company. And it's my job as the infrastructure provider to basically put together that scope that is best suited for you and make it go happen.
Okay. So, you know, let's say I come to you, I say to you, hey, I want to do 10 megawatts. I want to expand it maybe to, I don't know, 20 or 30 over time. I come to you, we sign all the agreements, then you go out and find me some land, I guess, that works. What is needed before we can enter sort of the next step in building out the site? Do you need a PPA in hand? power purchase agreement? Where does the power come from if I don't have my own infrastructure? What is needed for that? Lease? How do you transfer ownership of the real estate to myself?
Yeah, I mean, for our site development services, if you want to do an on-grid project, again, it just simply starts with a review of your capital outlay. Once you kind of pass our credit check, that credit check also gets your credit line approval to flow power to your site. So where most people kind of start from the land up, I start from the grid down. And so understanding like, hey, this client wants to go do a 10 megawatt project, you know, I go into my portfolio of identified interconnections, go select a few of the best locations that I know that will be the most servable, and start the interconnection process. The interconnection process just simply is a process for you to get interconnected into the grid and kind of study what kind of impact that you'll have within that grid system at that specific point. So after that grid interconnection process is kind of what I would call pre-approved, DIG then goes out on your behalf, identifies landowners in that interconnection point, and basically tees you up to execute a deal with that specific landowner. Once we have site control, the interconnection agreements are finalized. You sign and pay the cost, whatever they have to do at the transmission level to serve that power. And then after those agreements are signed, we then move into the final stage, which is the permitting process. So in Texas, you know, you're going to have a local, we have counties in Texas, so you're going to have some local county permitting to allow you to operate your mine. If you're inside a city jurisdiction, you know, you're going to have to go through city planning and get your city planning approval. Some cities are more advantageous to Bitcoin mining than others in Texas, and so you have to be a little bit selective in where you're placing these assets. And then if you're coming off of a public Texas roadway, you have to go through what's called TxDOT permitting, which is the Texas Department of Transportation. And so our company handles literally everything that I just told you from start to finish, totally turnkey. Obviously, we work with operators and their teams to keep them informed on our processes and helping them make decisions. But that's really the site development process. And then once all of that is completed and signed off, you now have site control. You have your approved capacity. You have your permits in place where now you can go and start constructing your infrastructure.
Let's say I'm not within a jurisdiction of a city or town, and I'm also not within the limits of public infrastructure, such as roads. If it's like land in the middle of nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. Is all of that land typically owned by somebody, and why? Like, who are the owners typically of the land that you buy?
Yeah, I mean, I deal, you know, obviously my background is in number one, all land is owned by someone in Texas. You know, there is even open range land is owned by the state. And then outside of, you know, public and governmental land ownership, you have private landowners. And, you know, the biggest thing of what's going on right now is you have all these kind of maybe foreign companies or people from outside of Texas trying to come into Texas, and you have a lot of landowners who kind of push people away because there's just, in Texas, we do business very differently. It's very, you know, by the book, shake a man's hand, very old school. And just with my family history in Texas, of being in Texas for over 200 years, I'm a landman by trade. And so I'm very effective in simply getting the door with folks, knowing how business is done in Texas, and just getting land deals done.
It's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, I would love to be fly on the wall of one of those deals, and I mean, just, you know, all kinds of of old school pictures in my head right now. But yeah, I mean, that's just super interesting to me. Like, you go and buy land, and either it belongs to the state or it belongs to someone. It's all zoned. And then you probably have to find a person first to contact if you're interested in buying it and all of that. Okay, next stage. I have the land, we're ready to build it out, right? Then what do you do? Do you typically build containerized sites or do you build buildings? When do you do one or the other?
You know, the biggest thing that you have to understand, Jesse, when you're building data infrastructure is you have to build for the climate environment that you're going in. I kind of have this imaginary line in West Texas where if a project is being developed kind of west of that line, you know, I really start to tell people like, hey, if you're going to do containerized solutions, you know, you better run a closed loop hydro system. You better run, you know, a closed loop immersion system just because sucking in air in some situations with a lot of dust particles or sediment in the air, you know, that's going to blow into your machines and it's really going to affect the life expectancy of your infrastructure. And so it's simply all just predicated on where you're at. I'm a really big believer in hydro and immersion solutions, just simply because with those solutions, you can literally build anywhere in Texas. Obviously, Texas has a lot of energy. We have a lot of land. We have a lot of infrastructure, but unfortunately, we have a lot of heat. And that's really the biggest hurdle that some operators have to kind of get over is how are we going to deal with heat in Texas? Now, luckily, during the in Texas, there what I would call the peak mining season is essentially from October to about the end of April, middle of May. So like we're basically kind of coming into the end of peak mining season in Texas. And what I mean by that is power prices are relatively low and a lot of times negative because we have so much generation, not enough transmission capacity. But once we start getting into the summer months, we call that peak demand in the ERCOT grid. What that means is you know, super hot outside, everyone's kicking up their AC, the energy usage starts to spike. And so miners are going to be curtailed more and more. And curtailment means simply shutting off your power supply and giving transmission capacity back to the grid, being demand response services. By curtailing and giving ancillary services back to the grid, miners in Texas have this new massive revenue stream that they can profit from. And so on average right now, there's four main programs in demand response. And the most profitable run right now is a program called ECRS. And what ECRS is, it essentially just means that you can respond to a curtailment signal within a 15-minute interval. So a signal is sent out for the ERCOT grid system. The power provider supplies it to their customer, you know, hey, Jesse Mining, you need to curtail within this 15-minute interval. Jesse Mining curtails, and then you're basically giving your transmission capacity back to the grid. So that ECRS program is paying about $265,000 per megawatt annually. So on a 10-megawatt project, you're clearing close to $2.65 million annually just by simply giving transmission capacity back to the grid. And that doesn't count if you also own any fixed blocks of energy that you're selling back to the grid as well. And so that's why, you know, the game in Texas, Jesse, is not only, you know, Bitcoin mining with competitive energy, but it's playing the energy arbitrage game and really selling your electricity back to the grid and giving your transmission capacity back.
But that's where, Ryan, that's where mining will move to. I mean, before you, I just spoke to Eric from Gridless, and that's a completely different game they're playing. But, you know, energy kind of works the same, because electrons flow independent of where they flow, right? And so they add value in a similar way, just a different fashion, you know, but it goes into the same direction. And I don't think that long-term, I mean, hell, even now at 57 per petahash per day, I don't think there's going to be much more room for just 100% uptime, full blast all the time, because that's, you know, we can make a lot more money, or your competition can make a lot more money not doing that, right? And I also think that blowing, I don't know, a gigawatt of hot air into the sky with mega farms is also not going to be, you know, a viable business model in the future, right? So, I mean, I want to talk about the energy after this sort of section here, and I want to go into more about energy pricing and what the uptime is that you guys sort of expect, and maybe also looking into the future. But if you say you do HPC and AI as well, right?
Correct.
I understand there's a difference between tier one and tier four data centers, and Bitcoin mining is very different. Can you, from your perspective, explain to me where you see the main differentiators between AI and Bitcoin mining, and you know why maybe Bitcoin mining still makes a lot of sense with all the power that you have available in Texas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to essentially just break down the different tiers of data centers, obviously you have tier one, two, three, or four. Tier one is just simply a very just simple setup with, you know, no redundancy, really very little cooling methods, right? I mean, most Bitcoin mining operations at a modular level operate off tier one and two, right? And so a tier one data center has pretty much no backup power, little to no cooling systems, okay? And that's tier one. Tier two will have some cooling, right? With that cooling, sometimes they might curve power, but it's really a tier two is really mainly just built off of operational uptime. You know, so those tier two data centers run about a 98% to 99% uptime. Tier three is going to have pretty advanced cooling, right, within the system, and they're also going to have backup reserve power. So it might be a natural gas generator, it might be a battery pack of some sort, it might be a microgrid, you know, with solar. But the biggest thing with the tier three data center is they have backup reserve power in case their, you know, grid application fails. And they have advanced cooling for their operations. A tier four data center is very, what I would like to call multi-redundant, right? So if they're one of their AC units goes down, they've got two backups for the backup. If their natural gas generator goes down, then their microgrid with batteries kicks online. And so tier four data centers just are multi-redundant in their operational processes. So most Bitcoin mining operations are tier one and two, and then high compute HPC GPU mines are tier three and four, mainly tier three, because tier four data centers are which are what I would call more traditional data centers with, you know, enterprise level traditional data systems that, you know, process data and simply can't turn off. So that's really the simple kind of breakdown of the levels that we see. And we are starting to see where data operators are starting to do kind of multifaceted approach where, hey, maybe one side of the facility is a modularized container, you know, tier two. And then they have a few, there is companies now starting to come out with tier three and four modular boxes. Maybe one side of the facility is optimized to be that high compute.
Interesting. What are we talking in dollars per megawatt for that different type of infrastructure? And when do folks typically want that amortized that come to you?
In terms of just the civil construction for a tier one and two data center on a modular level, you're probably looking at about $150,000 per megawatt plus or minus, depending on how type of container solution that you want to go. You know, the containers, what I like to say is I tell clients, hey, you can go buy a Honda, you can go buy a Ford, or you can go buy a Mercedes with a container, right? And there's different levels and scopes of cost associated with those automobiles. The same thing with containers. On the HPC side, you know, 1 megawatt of high compute power costs anywhere from $15 to $20 million. So your capital outlay, and that's just for the chips. The containers themselves, you know, around about that $125,000-$150,000 per megawatt, you know, all in construction costs with the container as well. But just the hardware on the HPC side is just so drastically different And so, you know, you really kind of see smaller scale HPC mines. 10 megawatt HPC mine is $100-120 million project. It's crazy the amount of capital that goes into high compute, but your return on capital with HPC GPU mining, you're looking at a 4 to 6 month ROI on your investment right now, which is pretty crazy. But the thing that I always tell people about HPC and GPUs right now is, yeah, you're at a 4 to 6 month break even ROI, but just the rate of adoption of new technology and chips that are coming out, you're constantly having to reinvest your dollars. And so it's not like these AI companies are sitting here just making some mountains of money. They are constantly reinvesting into their business and basically staying with technology.
Yeah, no, so that's, you know, just I wanted to underline that there's a further difference between, you know, if you build a tier one, tier two data center for Bitcoin mining, your horizon and your projections are completely different as well. Similar to the conditions that you operate in. I mean, even why? I mean, if the margins are so big, right? Why would AI or HPC data center operators want to save a cent and move to Texas in a super hot climate where they might have to have a lot higher expense per megawatt rather than moving into a more, you know, more easy climate to operate in and paying a little more for the power if your margins are so fat, you know?
At the end of the day, the big benefit of Texas is we have so much infrastructure, right? And there's so much energy, like literally, in the next 5 years, Texas has 60% of the forecasted new generation coming online in North America. That is crazy. In one state, we have 60% of the future generation capacity. So we have a lot of energy, a lot of growth opportunities, but you're absolutely right. Like, why wouldn't you mind paying a little bit of a premium for a little bit better of an operating condition? The answer to that is because of our deregulated power market, in the ways that you can monetize your infrastructure outside of just being a data operator, that is really the biggest benefit. So when the winter storm hit Texas 2 or 3 years ago, Winter Storm Uri, you know, if you would have had 10 megawatts online during that storm, curtailing and selling your energy back to the grid and getting transmission capacity via demand response, you would have made anywhere from $15 to $20 million in 72 hours. And so that is a crazy, it's a lot of money and it's a lot of opportunity. And so don't get me wrong, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages of every, you know, geographic climate you operate in. You know, if you're up in South Dakota or Iowa or, you know, some of these new emerging markets in the United States, winters get cold. I mean, you get below zero. I saw a picture from a client where their heater went down in their container. And this little system that they had set up to basically prevent snow from getting into their filters, I mean, it looked like an ice box in their container.
I saw that, yeah.
You know, the snow particles. Yeah, you saw that picture. Painful. So every operating condition has its advantages and disadvantages. It's just simply, hey, what do I want to go do? Do I want to get cheap power? Do I want to go pay a little bit of a premium to operate in a favorable condition? But, you know, there's never going to be a perfect favorable condition. Every mining area across the world is going to have its advantages and disadvantages.
How much of the power cost right now is electricity generation? And if you say there's, you know, so much more power generation coming online, where do you see power price move from where it is right now, between 3 and 4 cents and lower, in that region of the world?
So very good question, Jesse. In terms of, to give you an example in Texas, all right, Texas is a deregulated electricity market. Okay, in this deregulated electricity market, there's actually three types of electricity markets that you can buy electricity in. The first market is what's called the forward market, all right? And the forward market is essentially buying a fixed block of energy at a certain price. And so once you get into the summer months, you have what's called seasonality in the forward curve, right? So buying a fixed block of energy from the months of like, you know, June, July, August, September is not a good time to buy a fixed block of energy because you have that peak demand that we were talking about in your power pricing, right? Best times to buy power is basically January, February, March, April, October, November, because it's a little cooler weather, power prices are down, demand isn't quite there yet with peak demand. And so those are really the best times to buy power. So again, the fixed forward market is buying a block of energy for a certain time and volume. And you want to be sure that you're buying fixed energy in a good seasonality month. The other market is what's called the real-time market in Texas. The real-time market settles every 15 minutes with the price of natural gas. Okay. And remember, in Texas, there's four grid zones, west, north, south, and Houston. So right now, the listeners can actually download the ERCOT app on their phone and actually see this data. It's a great app to download. So right now, if we were mining in West Texas, you'd be paying 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour for power. Now, a lot of times in the day, in a off-season month, you'll see negative electricity prices. And what that means is there's so much power generation in the West Zone and not enough transmission infrastructure to get it to high demand markets that Bitcoin miners and data operators are essentially getting free supply side electricity to take power. And the reason why Bitcoin miners and data operators are so championed in our grid system is because getting all that congestion off power lines and being a baseload consumer is helping electrons flow more freely within the grid system, so power can get to high demand markets in a better, smooth, faster. So that's what we call stabilizing the grid, stabilizing the duck curve. So there's more baseload generation that can flow. There's more baseload consumption to stabilize. The other type of market that you can buy in is what's called the day ahead market. The day ahead market is essentially a bid and take model where, hey, I think tomorrow is going to clear at $34 a megawatt hour, and I'm going to go bid in $35 to make sure I get it. I don't necessarily advise Bitcoin miners and data operators to operate in the day ahead because it can be a little risky. So I mainly advise to play in the forward fixed market and the real-time market. So let's say you're a direct miner, Jesse, and you have 10 megawatts online, and you're saying, okay, you know, what's the best power product for me? In 2023, if you went 100% real-time power product and you were able to curtail and have a 95% uptime, you're looking at about a 3.8 cents per kilowatt hour all-in power cost that you could achieve. Now, the more you're willing to curtail, the less power price you're going to pay. So if you wanted to get down to, if you could curtail to 90 to 92%, you could be paying a 3.3 to 3.4 cents per kilowatt hour annually. It's just whatever, the more you're willing to curtail, the less power price you're going to pay. The more uptime that you need, the higher power price you're going to pay. It's just simple math. Now, what I advise people, when you're playing the energy arbitrage game in Texas, if you're running 100% real time, when you are curtailing via demand response, so when ERCOT sends a price signal and says, hey, we're hitting peak demand, we need industrial users to curtail. If you curtail and you don't own a fixed energy position in the grid, all you're simply doing is giving transmission capacity back to the grid via demand response, but you're not selling any energy into the grid. So if you're a 10 megawatt farm, what I advise people to usually do is do a 50% fixed hedge and a 50% float. And the reason I say that is when you curtail, you have 5 megawatts of capacity that you can sell into the grid and profit from, but you also have 50% of downside pricing and you can suck in that negative energy pricing. To give you an example, last August, we had a big heat wave hit Texas, and Riot made close to $30 million in the month of August playing the energy arbitrage game. And all these Bitcoin magazine and all these big publications came out and said, oh, you know, Riot made $30 million via demand response. How great is that? And Riot had to come back and say, no. We actually made like $8 million via demand response, and the rest was trading our energy position back to the grid. And that was because of a fixed energy position that they had within the grid system. And so really structuring your energy is a very important tool of maximizing profitability. But in regulated markets, you don't always have the bandwidth to dictate what type of competitive energy rates that you can get, and you don't necessarily have the full bandwidth to play the energy arbitrage game. Because usually in regulated markets, they're the ones playing the energy arbitrage game and making those profits. Now, they might, you know, take some cost off of your energy bill, but the benefit of being in a deregulated market like, you know, Texas, Ohio, or Pennsylvania is you own the energy. And that is your energy to basically sell back into the market and profit from. And so that's why I'm a very big proponent of deregulated electricity markets and really pushing for more states in the United States and across the world to become deregulated energy markets. Saudi Arabia, I just got back from Dubai a couple months ago. Saudi Arabia is in the process of deregulating their electricity market. I think that's going to be just a massive benefit because they have so much energy generation, transmission infrastructure that they need to keep building out. They have a beacon across the world for the benefits of electricity deregulation.
I would argue there's no other market in which, you know, in which a free market is as important as energy, because you've got that constant need for equality between demand and supply, which is 60 hertz where you are and 50 hertz where I am, mm-hmm. right? And it's real time, all the time. You know, you cannot have any room for human error. And, you know, any sort of regulation in energy markets always introduces that noise that makes it harder to reach that goal. Any public funding always leads to stranded capacity somewhere. You see that where I am in Africa, in Ethiopia, South Africa, you see that like very clearly, right? And it's not that clear where you are. It's very clear in Germany as well. A lot of government funding, a lot of incentives, lots of subsidies, you know, and all of a sudden you end up with an electricity price of 40 euro cents, 44 dollar cents, which is absolutely crazy per kilowatt mm-hmm. hour, right? And so, yeah, I asked myself why. I mean, I'm a big proponent of geodiversification, right? And mm-hmm. I think miners should strive to do so. But if you're starting out, I feel like there's hardly a better place to do so for your first 50 megawatts than Texas, because the regulation is great. You've got that freedom. You don't have that political risk. Energy pricing is insanely good, right? It's hard to find those prices. I can have, as you said, my 5 megs and overclock them as soon as the prices go negative mm-hmm. or below 1 cent or whatever, and just make bank. I can even say, hey, I'm going to, you know, use M30 S++s, keep my capex low if I don't have much money, and build up the site later and put more efficient machines. And I just spoke to Eric. They also have, again, similarities, right? Because energy always works the same everywhere. So they use their ASICs in sort of a pyramid. Don't want to call it a pyramid scheme, but in a pyramid fashion where they have different efficiency levels, right? And the least efficient miners, they turn off first. And similar here, like, you know, the higher the power price, you know, the more you turn off miners, absolutely. Essentially, and you leave the least efficient miners on, you know, at the most expensive power pricing. I hope that's the right way of explaining that. But yeah, before we have to wrap up, Ryan, I want to talk to you about cybersecurity. Please tell me why I should worry about cybersecurity and why I should engage with you on digging that tool out of the toolbox as well. Yeah, explain.
Absolutely. You know, cybersecurity is something that really just gets overlooked in our industry so much. Everyone thinks, oh, the blockchain's super secure. You know, we're not vulnerable. That's really not the case. There's so many backdoor loopholes that people can gain to sensitive data within your company, whether it be the back office, whether it be just simply ransomware, whether it be just simply hacking the data in the facility level. I think last year alone in the crypto industry, close to like $40 or $50 billion of losses were impacted for cybersecurity scams, hacks. And so it's a growing number. It's something that people really don't like to talk about because obviously no one likes losing money. And so, you know, protecting yourself, number one, starting with your own personal self, how you protect your cell phone, how you protect your emails, how you protect your home computer, types of systems that you operate is so vastly important, because that's the first thing that we tell people in educating cybersecurity is like, look, it starts with yourself. It doesn't start with the facility. Before you even go build the facility, you have to understand the importance of cybersecurity and have the processes, controls, and the team to basically put those things in motion. So before we even go and build infrastructure, we really get around these teams and teach them and put the processes, controls in place to protect them at the enterprise level. And then once we move into the infrastructure, it's putting the tools in place at the facility level, from the firmware to basically the facility to basically protect from attacks. And then once all of that's in place, the ongoing maintenance and monitoring of both sides of the equation is vastly important, because digital assets are very vulnerable. Don't get me wrong, I love Bitcoin. I've been into Bitcoin a long time, but hacks happen every day. I have a friend, this is a very unfortunate story, that one of his family members was trying to go buy a house just recently, and they were going to sell their Bitcoin as a down payment, and they turned on their supposed cold wallet, and the Bitcoin was gone. And it's a sad, tough story. I had another client who was, you know, paying for some machines, and somewhere in translation, the Bitcoin didn't end up in the wallet that it was supposed to get up. And that was because of people just monitoring ransomware type situations and figuring out keys and a wallet. So there's a process that you really have to go through. It's a multifaceted approach of how you protect your infrastructure, how you protect yourself, and how you protect your digital assets.
Yeah, I mean, just to for the record, right, hacking the blockchain, of course, to anybody new to Bitcoin listening to this, once a transaction is on there, mm-hmm. you're pretty good, you're pretty safe. Anything that happens before then, you know, you copying wrong addresses because there's malware on your computer, you getting wrench attacked, obviously that has nothing to do with Bitcoin, but all with the operator. And I didn't actually think about that. Like, let's say I wanted to build a mine 10 megs, and somebody had, you know, I don't know, 2 years ago, figured out a vulnerability on me, and later on, you know, hacks my phone, changes settings, gets into my mind, changes the pool address without me knowing, all of that stuff, has to be considered. And I don't think it's wildly known or appreciated or adopted as well. How hard of a time do you have, Ryan, selling cybersecurity to mid, large, and small scale?
You know, the conversations are always very welcomed. At first, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, we don't really need it. You know, we're protected. And then it's just simple conversations of, well, how are you protecting yourself? How are you protecting your enterprise? How are you protecting this? How are you protecting that? What are you doing at facility level to prevent intrusions? And then once you start those conversations, people realize that they're vulnerable. And having those vulnerabilities is not a fun conversation. You know, I don't really necessarily like to instill fear in people, but sometimes you have to, because it's better to be safe than sorry. And so the operational processes and the team that we put together to safeguard digital assets is really industry leading. And it just starts with a really tough conversation. And once people kind of put their guard down and realize that I have to entrust a team of people, and because not one data operator can do everything. Right. I mean, there's some teams that are great finance guys. There's teams that are great data operators. There's teams of guys that are great energy people. But there's very few groups out there that are great teams of cybersecurity professionals. And so, partnering with groups that really have your best interest at heart and have the capabilities to provide, you know, turnkey solutions for your business is the utmost importance.
Yeah, it takes a good salesperson to be able to be empathetic to people opening up to vulnerabilities. But I would hope that with the people in Bitcoin that you have to deal with, you know, you find people that are open-minded enough to maybe accept that they don't know much about nothing after they learned the same thing within the finance sector. Ryan, I have to bring you back for more talk on energy and operation. I got two more questions for you. The first one is there anything that I didn't ask you that I wish I had? Anything you want to cover still?
No, I appreciate you having me on. You know, again, Digital Infrastructure Group, we are simply here to support the industry with site development, construction, and asset management services. We're a big believer in the benefits of the greatest energy optimization tool on earth, and that is Bitcoin mining. And, you know, our company is solely dedicated to furthering this industry, and look forward to obviously working with you, Jesse, and having continued conversations.
I think I know what your answer is going to be to the next one. I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think that Bitcoin uses enough energy or not?
So that's a fantastic question. People are like inundated to think that using too much energy is a bad thing. Using energy in a effective way is a massively great thing. And Bitcoin miners consume energy at a baseload level, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And what's big is it's basically incentivizing new power generation to come online. It's incentivizing new transmission infrastructure to be built. And it is 20 years from now, we're going to look back and see how data operators were really the main catalyst in driving our modern grid system. So way back in the early 1900s, it was ice factories in Texas that basically were the first baseload consumer that helped build out our electrical grid system in Texas, ice factories. And so 110 years later, these data centers are those ice factories that are propelling our grid system and our generation output to next levels. And I think 20 or 30 years from now, we're going to look back and see the massive impact this industry has had, and I'm very proud to be a part of it.
I fully agree with you, Ryan. Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much for your time. Guys, next Sunday, we'll talk mining again. I really hope you learned something new. If you did, you know what to do. Leave a like, leave a subscription. Swan and I will appreciate it. Not sure yet which episode we're going to release. I'm going to go to Bitcoin Asia pretty much soon. So I'm trying to pre-produce a couple episodes here. You know, I've got some amazing guests lined up, including some more mining around Africa, a lawyer as well coming online pretty soon, and much more. Guys, if you, again, learn something new, you know what to do. I'll see you next Sunday. And with that, I'll say bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.